presents pragmatic approaches to remedial investigation, technology selection, and remediation successes. This session will be offered by Tom Cady, who is here with EPA's Environmental Response Team. Tom is a member of the ERT, or Environmental Response Team, which is a field support arm of the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Tom's area of focus is in advancing the state-of-the-art real-time direct sensing technologies to streamline crucial aspects of remedial investigations, remediation system designs, and system performance monitoring. Tom also serves as a lead on organizational reviews for mine sites and other Superfund sites in various phases of investigation and remediation. With that introduction, I would like to call up the materials and go ahead and turn things over to your speaker, Tom Cady, again, from EPA's Environmental Response Team, to start his technical session. Tom, whenever you're ready, please begin.
Okay.
And Tom,
hello, everybody.
Just a quick reminder, before you go any bigger, I'm going to restore that, and you actually want to click the full screen button, not the maximize. So go ahead and try that one.
Okay. Okay, I just did.
Thank you.
Am I good? Okay.
You're all good.
Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, for joining. I know we have a fairly large crowd out there, so I appreciate your time, and hopefully I can make it worthwhile for you all. So, yeah, as Gene said, I'm with the Environmental Response Team, and what we do is support all 10 regions of EPA, in particular the on-scene coordinators and the remedial project managers with their sites. So there are our customers, but also our customers, obviously, as everybody else on the line, too, the industry practitioners and the site owners and, you know, people that have these problems and obviously the general public, too. So you're all customers. We're all stakeholders in this. And, you know, I'm hopeful that this presentation opens our eyes to possibilities of working together and doing the things that we do in new ways and exciting ways. I find that a lot of these things that we'll talk about have really changed the way I think about the profession, and hopefully you will too. So I've got about 35 years of experience. I don't think we have any pictures up there. I refuse to let people see my pictures or go on camera, but because it's nothing anybody wants to see. But in those 35 years, it's about equally split as a consulting engineer, as a remediation construction contractor, and as a regulator with EPA. My entire career has been pretty much an assessment and remediation type work. So having worked on all those sides, you know, I try to present a balanced perspective, and I think I've gotten over the years a balanced perspective of what most people are looking for in a site, and generally we agree more than we disagree. So that's the good news. So let me go to the next slide here. Administrator Pruitt, back in early summer in May, commissioned a Superfund task force. He wanted people to take a look at how we could streamline Superfund. You know, one of his big emphasis with EPA is the Superfund program and getting properties cleaned up more quickly and back into productive use. So he gave people 30 days to come up with the best ideas that they have to make a difference with the Superfund program, and that was called the Superfund Task Force. And in those 30 days, well over 100 people you know, contributed their ideas throughout EPA. And this report that I'm showing you the cover page of was put out, and it's accessible on the EPA website. I think you just go to epa.gov and search Superfund Task Force, and you'll see this. And the report is broken into a number of strategies to clean up sites more quickly, how to fund them differently, how, you know, this little paragraph at the bottom of the Superfund Task Force cover page explains the five strategies. And in that, we do have a number of strategies and a number of recommendations that will help us to effectuate the strategy of making these things happen. This presentation touches on two of them directly. This recommendation number five, it's you know, how do we clarify our priorities in our IFS? And when we identify things that need to be dealt with quickly, you know, use early actions or interim actions to deal with those immediate risks. And I'll talk a little bit about risks in a general sense in just a bit. The second recommendation, and there's an intro paragraph to that that you could read on your own, but, you know, we have so many new tools now. A lot of these were developed in the 1990s, but, you know, over the last two decades, they have really, really advanced, and so has our ability to handle massive amounts of data. So the tools and the data technology has really matured to a point where we can get massive amounts of data in real time and see things with much more clarity than we were able to decades before. Even with these technologies, the data technologies hadn't really caught up at that point. It was really in its infancy. But now we really have some very powerful tools, and this is what this presentation will focus on. So how do we use this? It's recommendation number 9, use these state-of-the-art technologies to expedite our cleanups. In particular, we'll talk about some real-time investigation techniques and how to use 3D and 2D data visualization and how to share that on the sharing platform so that we can make decisions as teams rather than have one group out doing an investigation and months later we see a report and then everybody reviews and comments that report on that report. You know, how can we do these things together and streamline that entire process? So here's what this presentation will focus on. Key points, like I said, we'll spend some time on direct sensing high-resolution technologies. I know we have a large crowd, so, you know, this is the approach that I took. You know, less is more, simpler is better than complicated. You know, I would like to get across in a, not a really simplistic, but, you know, in a general sense on more simplistic sites, what these tools can do for you. And, you know, we'll have a couple of examples of complicated sites where we use these same tools and what we were able to achieve with that. But I don't want to lose anybody. I know some people will be experts in these things already and they're looking to learn just a little bit more, hopefully. And some people, maybe this is brand new too, so we're trying to just keep this germane to everybody who's taken time to join us today. So we'll talk about that. We'll get into the nitty-gritty a little bit about how to read these boring logs and just exactly what they tell you so that you get an understanding for them. You know, mostly everything is in microvolts or, you know, millisiemens per minute, per meter, and, you know, units that we're often not used to in this field. So, you know, we'll take a little time to look at that to get everybody up to speed, and we'll get into a couple case studies. The second thing that we'll talk about is data as a deliverable. This is where the data technology has caught up, and we no longer look for hard copy reports, you know, when we can get live electronic data. And in particular, what we've been doing with this data over the last several years is we have our contractors in the field upload the data from every boring log at the either immediately after the boring was taken or at the end of the day so that the entire stakeholder team has access to this data. Some people like to use certain models to visualize this data. Other people like to use other techniques to do it. But everybody gets the data. Everybody has the opportunity to evaluate the site in the way that they are most comfortable. And then what we do is the next morning we all get together on a conference call and we talk about what we see and we decide as a team where the next boring should go so that we can build the conceptual site models together as a team rather than individually. So hopefully by the time the crew has demobed the site, everybody has gotten the information that is important to them, and we're not coming up with a list of data gaps and a list of things we should have done when we were out there because we're all involved as the field work's going on. Now, you don't have to sit at your desk and watch every boring being done. You get an email, you know, when the boring log's done, or you can look at it at the end of the day, or you can look at it just before the call the next morning. But everybody has the data, the opportunity to evaluate it, and all stakeholders, whether you're the public, an Indian tribe, state regulator, a technical expert, a consulting firm, we can all be on the line together and develop these conceptual site models together. It's been an amazing aha moment for us about how we can really streamline our reporting and comment and conceptual site model development process and cut to the chase so that we can take actions that will save everybody a lot of money and eliminate a lot of risk. The third thing that we'll talk about is exactly that, kind of what I mentioned here, this collaborative decision-making process, these tools that are available to us so that we can work as a team rather than individuals on these sites. Okay, so I'll have about 10 slides that are just overview, conceptual things. This is not EPA policy. This entire presentation is not EPA policy. These are things that we're talking about now and how we can make things better, do things faster, take advantage of our resources and optimize our time and optimize the money that we spend to achieve the greatest good and get as many of these properties back to productive reuse as quickly as we can. So some of these things are personal opinions. Some of these things are just things that we have experienced. This is a conversation on things that can be done, things that we are doing, and we're sharing this conversation with all of you because you're the practitioners and the people with some of these issues, and we want to get that conversation out and about because as an industry group, we'll be able to tackle this and make changes. So pragmatic. I use that term a lot, and here's some of the ideas I mean by pragmatic. You know, we have all of these boxes here that are all shades of gray. And these percentages, this is just the opacity or transparency that I have for each of these things. So, you know, the box on the left here is 99% black. So it's not black. You know, it's 1% white. And on the far side, we have what looks to be a white square, but it's 1% black. And then you have all the shades of gray in between. And what I mean by pragmatic, if something's 99% one way or 1% the other, you know, let's call it that. Don't get hung up in the shades of gray, particularly when there's an overriding consideration that makes our decision black or white. And oftentimes there is a practical aspect to a project that negates a lot of the debates that we might have on, you know, well, should this be 100 parts per million at cleanup level or should it be, you know, 150? Sometimes the equipment you use, you know, is a certain size or a certain technology or use a certain safety area from an engineering point of view. When you have everything out there, it really doesn't matter. So, you know, let's kind of cut to the chase and call black when it's almost always black, and if something's almost pure white, you know, let's call that white. So let's talk about a little bit of these things, these pragmatic investigation opportunities, I feel. This is something that someone told me in 1985 when I first joined EPA. So I worked here for 5 years back in the 80s. And a consulting firm came in and gave us a presentation on how to clean up sites. And this one gentleman said, you know that, you know, 98% of your mass resides in less than 2% of the volume of your plume. And, you know, being an engineer looking for ways to take advantage of cleanups, you know, and back then I was an on-scene coordinator. We had, when I first started, we had 6 months and $1 million to eliminate immediate risk. So that changes your mindset. 6 months and $1 million, get it done. Shortly after that, they bumped it up to 1 year and $2 million, which is a little more realistic given some of the situations we had back in the day. But when you think that way, when you have a finite amount of money and a finite amount of time, you know, what do you need to do so that you can eliminate a substantial imminent threat to human health and the environment? So anyway, this was it for me. And throughout my entire career, I think this one nugget that this gentleman gave us in that training point has kind of guided my whole career. And my experience has been, if you look for that 2%, find that 2% small volume footprint that contains 98% of the mass of contaminant that's been released to the environment, and focus on that, you will be amazed at how many symptomatic problems that we spend a lot of time and a lot of investigation money and a lot of effort trying to deal with when it's only dealing with 2% of the mass. It's a massive amount of money. On many projects, most of the effort is spent on this 2%, and the 98 sits there. And it's kind of the goose that keeps laying the golden eggs. You know, it's And we'll get into this a little bit, so I won't go on any more with that. But we'll be going back to this 98%, 2%. And I don't want people to just take my word for these things. Look at your sites, you know. Do a mass calculation in your source area and do a mass calculation in the total volume of your plume and see how many times this works out for you. And oftentimes it does. It's a very eye-opening experience when you realize you may be chasing molecules when you've got pounds or tons of material that is causing this problem or has caused this problem. And here's an example of the 98 or 99 and 1. Solubilities of DNAPLs and LNAPLs, you know, they're the Na in DNAPL and LNAPL is non-aqueous. These are non-water soluble compounds, and they are somewhat soluble in water, but less than 0.1%. So, you know, from an engineering point of view, I don't look at these as water soluble compounds. And in fact, I like to personalize chemicals. I like to think like a chemical. And these chemicals hate water. They love oil. They're great degreasers, you know, and they're great fuels. Many of them are oils, and the chlorinated solvents are great degreasers. So they are soluble in oil and vice versa, you know. But they hate water. They ball up in water just like you would if somebody threw you into a vat of acid. You're going to curl up into a little ball. It's just what they do, you know. Minimize the surface area, avoid the water at all costs, and what they end up doing is either sinking down to a clay layer and pulling out there, or they say, finally, I'm out of this water, and they're on their own layer of their own, or they saturate into that clay or a silt layer, and they'll hang out there. And that's where the mass hangs out, and they gradually diffuse out on a molecular level slowly over time, and that's where that 0.1% is. And that 0.1% doesn't want to be in there either. You know, they're out of their comfort zone, and as soon as they cross some sort of silt layer or a clay layer, as the groundwater moves them through the geology, they will absorb to that or entrain in that as quickly as they can. So one thing we've seen with this direct sensing technology is that oftentimes this idea that we always had of a dissolved phase plume is not necessarily the case. These contaminants have been filtered out by the geology, by these lenses that these compounds would rather be in. And what we're seeing oftentimes are diffusion plumes coming out of these lenses, not dissolved phase plumes that have moved off from the source. They originated at the source. They were filtered out by the geology, and now they're residing in these lenses, and that's where they are. And what we're seeing in the groundwater is a symptom of this soil lens that has a saturated, some degree of saturated compounds residing in that soil lens. So with that, we'll move on. Remedial investigation, 5 basic questions. You'll notice that I'm not going to use Superfund terms lots of times. I think a lot of the terminology that we've used over the years forms these connotations that we've always had over the years. So we're using a lot of new types of language, I think, as an industry group to maybe get away from some of these terms that have very specific connotations. One thing, though, is a remedial investigation. You know, I emphasize the word remedial. The reason we're doing it, in my view, a remedial investigation is trying to figure out, you know, what do I need to do to solve the problem? What information do I need to understand the problem and solve the problem? It's about the remediation phase. So I ask 5 questions. And, you know, the very first question is, if my slide will work. Actually, Gene, I'm having trouble here. Not advancing. Gene, are you there? Is anybody there?
I'm here. Don't worry, Tom.
Okay.
So, I didn't leave you. So you're unable to advance your slides right now?
No, they won't go.
Okay. Yep,
there we go. It works with a mouse, not with the buttons anymore. Okay, that's fine. Okay, so the first question that I like to ask, is there an unacceptable risk that warrants action? And of course, the first thing we think about in the profession, certainly at EPA, is, you know, is there an unacceptable human health or environmental risk? But there are a lot of other risks at a project, too, and it is not working, Jean.
Okay, Tom. So we will go ahead and help you out.
Okay, great. So are there third-party lawsuits? you know, am I at risk of damaging my corporate reputation or brand image? You know, that's a very severe risk for a lot of corporations. You can keep on going, Gene. This is the one I like. Is there going to be increased project complexity or cost or the time of my overall project if I don't do something immediately? That, to me, that's a big risk. And, you know, are we risking our property value? You know, these sites, you know, have a big impact on property values, where they occur, and then oftentimes adjacent properties. So a lot of these things are unacceptable risks. It's not just human health or the environment. There are a lot of things that drive project risk, and this is just a short list of some of those things. Hey, Gene, I think you're going to have to operate this from now on. Okay, so if there is an unacceptable risk, what is the root cause? And again, I go back to follow that 98-2 rule. You know, where is 98% of the mass residing? That's what causes the problem. It's that massive contaminant. And if there is a high mass, low volume footprint, there is no better way to focus and optimize your efforts than to go after and attack that and get it under control or remediated so that you don't have all of these follow-on problems. Is there any way we can get this back for me, Gene, that I can do this? Let me try something here.
Yeah, we'll try one thing here, Tom. Do you see the pointer on the screen?
No, I don't.
You do not see the pointer.
There it is.
Okay. Can you try to move that around on the screen for me?
A little delayed, but it's not working like it was before. But
okay, so are you able to click on it now and try?
Yeah, I can move it. It's just delayed. And now I made it disappear, unfortunately.
Okay. So, Tom, we can go
forward. Maybe there's
just
a delay on my end.
Yeah, I think it's your local connection there. So it probably will be just more time effective to just say next, and just let me know, and I'll click for you.
Okay, fine. All right. So if we do have, what is that root cause? So I already went through that one. The next one is, you know, what actions will control that root cause quickly and cost effectively? And there are a number of things that we need to know. And one is, what is the spatial distribution of that high mass footprint? And that tells us where to remediate. Gene, next.
So, Tom, I just want to be sure that you're not clicking anything on your end.
No, I'm not.
Okay, so we should have question number 4 up on the screen.
Okay, so I'll go back to 3 a little bit now that the bullets are up. But three things that we like to know. You know, what is the spatial distribution of that contaminant? That tells us where to remediate. But we also need to know the matrix distribution of the contaminant. That tells us how to remediate. You know, we're certainly not going to do vent and sparge in a clay formation. It's difficult to do injection in a clay formation. You know, if we have sandy soils, then vent and sparge would work well. So we need to understand the matrix where this contaminant resides. And then finally, we also need to do a field pilot test. You know, environmental data and engineering data are two different things. So if we do feel that vent and sparge might be a good technology on a site, we still don't know how many wells we need, how we need to space them, what our radius of influence would be, if we can get air through the formation with our sparge points and things like that. So without that information, you're designing a system blind. So you need these field pilot tests, too, in order to optimize the performance, the design and the performance, and ultimately your costs of remediation. 4, are there secondary problems? And these are the problems I call symptoms that require action too. So we may have a source, but we may have migrating vapors from that source causing a vapor intrusion problem. So I look at that as the secondary symptomatic problem of our root cause problem, which is that high mass area that these vapors are emanating from. So do we have those sorts of problems, and do we need to deal with them, you know, immediately, concurrently, or subsequent to dealing with our high mass area? And next, Gene.
And Tom, just so you know, it appears that there's a lag on your local network connection because number 5 has been up for a little bit on the screen.
Wow.
So it might be helpful if you refer to the hard copy, and then that way we can go on at a more timely pace.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So do we have high confidence that the above actions will accomplish the following? You know, the first thing we'd like to do is stabilize the situation. Don't have time working against us. If things are getting worse by the day, time is of the essence to control that, control your overall project costs and effectiveness of the situation. Once we get time neutralized so that the situation is stable, how can we improve that situation and ideally get time working for us? And then if time's working for us but not quickly enough, what can we do so that we can set the conditions for natural attenuation to occur in an acceptable time frame? So, Gina, I'm assuming you're moving on, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, this is going to be very difficult with this animation because I can't.
So I'm going to let you know just visually. So we're going to open up the conceptual site model animation, and we are clicking the first animation, and the first animation has appeared.
Yeah, and I can't see it.
And so that's why I'd encourage you to look at the hard copy or the local copy, and then I'll just verbally describe to you on the phone what we're triggering in the animation if you're unable to follow along live.
Okay. Oh, well, the first animation ought to be, you know, a release in the subsurface, and let's call this a, you know, chlorinated solvent release. So you should have that bright red area where you have the initial release. In the second animation, we should have vapors coming up from that release. So these are typical problems that we encounter. Then, once we have that first release, so we have two major threats. We have a vapor intrusion threat to the building. We can have a work shutdown, employee comp, or workman's comp problems and things like that. And we also have a threat to groundwater, which should be up next, you know, as this migrates down to the water table. As it does so, we have more vapors coming off of that material that's migrating in the vato zone. And since chlorinated solvent vapors are heavier than air, they settle down at the water table. And, of course, they follow the water table, which we all know slopes in a particular direction, the direction of groundwater flow. So oftentimes we're worried about vapors coming up out of a plume, but vapors in the vato zone will follow that exact same line. Because they'll go to the lowest point they possibly can, so they follow the top of the water table, too. And the next animation, I think, should show these vapors coming up toward homes. If people in homes put on a whole house fan or have some sort of negative pressure in their home, vapors, as we all know, will follow the tiniest of negative pressure gradients. So it's just like smoke from a campfire. You know, it seems that it always goes in your direction. But we've all seen smoke just following, you know, any sort of negative vapor trail. So it's very easy for these vapors to be pulled up into the homes. Next, we have contaminated groundwater. As we go down into the water table, still most of our mass is up in the vato zone, and as this is trickling down through the water table, we still have a high mass situation, but not as much. And eventually, we do have this dissolved phase plume where this low mass footprint starts moving out with the groundwater. Okay. Hopefully that was okay because I can't see any of this that's going on. Are we on the next slide, Jean?
We are, and there's the cost of time.
Okay, so what is the cost of time? So again, with this first release, I'm just throwing some numbers out. These are just anecdotal numbers, but you know, you can have a release like this in a 1 to 6 month time period. And if you're able to catch it at this point, oftentimes you can clean something like this for $250,000 to $500,000. Sounds like a lot of money, but it's easy to spend that much with these kinds of releases. If we go into the next stage where we have the vapor intrusion issue and we also have this migration down to the water table, which happens oftentimes in just another 6 to 12 months, by I think a lot of these sites, by a year's time, these releases have reached the water table. You're up to $500,000 to $1 million And I think these are conservative numbers. I'm sure there are people out there, much higher numbers than this. As these vapors move along, and if you have a vapor intrusion problem, well, at least $200,000, and the possibility of third-party lawsuits that you're dealing with. Again, as you start then migrating down into the water table, that might take somewhere between a year to a year and a half after the initial release. You've just added $1 to $2 million. So in a very short amount of time, your project is growing in complexity, and because of that complexity, there's extra investigation, there's extra remediation, there's different types of remediation required, and you know, suddenly you've gone from $250,000 cleanup to a $2.25 million cleanup. And if this groundwater plume moves off your site and to a municipal well or whatever, you have natural resource damages, you've contaminated aquifers, it can be, you know, it only takes a year or two for these things to start happening. And lots of times these are much older than that. And then you have these extensive plumes and just add $3 to $5 million on the short side. And depending on your particular site, you can add zeros to the time and you can add zeros to the dollars. So there are plenty of sites that are, you know, they can take 30 years or more to clean up and they can be hundreds of millions of dollars. So the point of this slide is time is of the essence, always. So we'll go to the next slide. The next slide is, you know, but what if that's always my situation? Because I know that's the first thing people say. It's wonderful to catch a problem early on, but oftentimes we don't, and we end up with this full-blown situation. So what do we do in that situation? And I'll go with the first animation, Gene. My advice is let's go control and remediate the 98% mass footprint, this high mass, low volume footprint in the 2% zone, the 2% footprint. That's the source of all of your problems. And the next animation would say, you know, we also have to protect the receptors out in that 2% mass area, that 98% footprint. We still need to protect the homeowners. We need to protect municipal wells and things like that. But if we're going to focus our efforts, we have to get control over that source area. So let's say this was just a 100-pound release, which is actually not all that unreasonable with a dry cleaner, something like that. 100 pounds is actually a fair amount of chlorinated solvents and can cause a lot of problems. So if we focus our efforts out in the 98% footprint, doing the groundwater plume and figuring out where it went and spending a lot of investigation dollars and a lot of investigation time, and let's say we did a fully successful remediation, and we fully cleaned that plume up, but we didn't deal with the source. You know, so this is dividing your OUs up. Well, let's tackle the groundwater, and then we'll go back to the site area where we had the source. So if I had 100 pounds, and 2 pounds got away from me in this area, and I clean up that entire area at great time and great expense, what do I have back in the source area? I've got 98 pounds. I effectively have the identical situation that caused the entire problem. So that's my way of trying to, you know, emphasize how important it is to deal with this source area, because you can clean up an entire plume and effectively done nothing but start the clock back to zero again, and the problems all begin over. Okay. So next slide, what about historical releases? You know, again, we found this from a number of optimization reviews that were done over the years, and we've done hundreds of these at EPA, looking at pump and treat systems. Generally, it was started to look at systems after the fact. How can we improve the performance of this treatment system? And what we found, the overriding answer was that the source area was never adequately characterized and adequately remediated. We cleaned the aquifer by pumping out that dilute plume, but the source area, because these compounds are not water soluble, you know, most of the source is in that area, and we really hadn't done much mass removal at all. So we still had a source area that needed delineation and needed to be dealt with, or our pump and treat system would literally have to run forever. So that's the point of that slide with the historical releases. So 10 things to know and why. Are you there, Jean, on that slide?
I am. Yep, we're on that slide. Okay, number one.
I completely thought. Okay, I'm sorry. I was just curious to see if I caught up, but my screen is just blank at this point. Okay, 10 things to know why. And what I'm leading to with these 10 things is do we have instruments now that can tell us these things in real time? And the answer is yes. So one, source area in the beta zone. We need to know that because, you know, is there a groundwater threat or is there a vapor intrusion threat? Two, we want to know, you know, what is the porosity and permeability of this beta zone? And the reason we need to know that is, you know, are there vapor control options so that we can control these vapors? You know, what? How much time do we have until this material gets to the groundwater so that we can avoid that impact? And what are extraction options or treatment options for this material so that we can get after it quickly? And third thing we want to know is what is the depth of water? We need to know that for a couple reasons. One, again, is how much time do we have before this material gets to the groundwater and adds another $1 million to my project? And, of course, what is the direction of groundwater flow so that we can evaluate, you know, which what the potential receptors we have. And also we want to know if we might have a DNAP or an LNAP problem once we get to the water table. The next item is water table fluctuation. This is particularly important with an LNAP because it creates a smear zone, which could be one of the most difficult zones to clean up. So, you know, we do want to know how much this water table is moving up and down over the years. And what is the permeability of that smear zone? Because it is so difficult to clean up and crucial to clean up, we want to know what technologies do we have available to us to deal with that smear zone, since it ends up being a residual source that can be a real problem from keeping a site to getting to closure. Next, direction of groundwater flow. I already mentioned that, why that's important. What is our plume thickness when we are out in the plume? You know, so how do we need to, how can we treat that? How can we intercept it? The next thing, number eight, is, you know, are there permeability lenses in the saturation zone? So do we have lenses in the geology that are filtering out these contaminants and storing them and causing these diffusion plumes that I mentioned early on? And then, of course, 9 and 10, very important things from a remediation point of view is where is this high mass footprint? Where's that mass distribution of the contaminant, particularly zeroing in on that 98% mass footprint? And, again, what is that matrix distribution so that I know what remedial options are available? I can actually see this next slide. So this next slide has a lot of details on it, and I'm not going to go into everyone, but there, suffice it to say, there are a lot of technologies now that are available to do this. If we have chlorinated solvents, we have a membrane interface probe and hydraulic profiling tool that can tell us exactly where our contaminants are in the formation in real time, and they can also give us the permeability behavior of the formation, you know, on literally at the inch level as we advance our boring down to refusal. So at every inch, we can understand what our permeability behavior is of the various lenses that we have in the subsurface and where those contaminants are hanging up in that subsurface. If we have an oil of some sort, you know, there are a number of laser-induced technology, laser-induced fluorescence technologies that we can use, and typically they're combined with a cone penetrometer. So that cone penetrometer gives us great geotechnical information and this soil lithology, again, at a half centimeter reading at a time. So each half centimeter, we understand that the behavior of the geology, and with the laser-induced fluorescence, we can also understand where our oil is. And we have a mixture of oils. These technologies with laser-induced fluorescence will give us a characteristic wavelength or set of wavelengths so that we can understand when we're looking at a gasoline or when we're looking at a diesel fuel, when we're looking at a heavy end contaminant. And oftentimes if we're at a creosote site or something like that, we'll use TARGOS, which is a special laser-induced technology that is designed to detect these heavy hydrocarbons. So these are just a number of things. Another technology that just came out that I haven't used yet, but I would like to use is GeoProbe's optical imaging profiler, where they literally have a camera in the GeoProbe tool, and they're looking at the formation as they advance the probe continuously, taking photographs under UV light and under visible light. So you can look at a log of your soil column and actually see, you know, where you have these oils, or we're thinking about using it possibly on a mercury site. You know, you let the visible light, you know, highlight where you have beads of mercury in the subsurface to find the source of mercury contamination on a particular site. So you could use the fluorescence, which is good to highlight where you might have an oil in the subsurface, or the visible light sometimes, if it's a dirty oil or a black contaminant, you could see that against the soil, or even something like mercury with the high reflection that you get from mercury. We may be able to see that in real time and understand where it is. Their output is pretty much in pixels of your camera. So, you know, you take a photograph as you advance the probe. You can look at these photographs at any point in your boring log. And if you have 100% of your pixels are fluorescing from the UV light or the visible light, you can pretty much just, you know, decide what percentage of the window you're seeing. You can get an idea if you're looking at an L-NAPL or a D-NAPL, or just mild levels of contamination. But you actually have to see the contamination. It's not going to work with dissolved phase materials. Dakota Technologies have done a lot of the laser-induced fluorescence work over the years, development of these tools. They now have a dye life, they call it. Again, this is used for chlorinated solvent work, where they inject the dye into the formation, much like the hydraulic profile tool will inject water into the formation to understand the behavior of that formation from a permeability point of view. But this dye will also dissolve the chlorinated solvents and give off a different fluorescence when it does not have chlorinated solvents in it versus when it does have chlorinated solvents dissolved in it. So it's a great way to find L-NAPL or D-NAPL actually for a chlorinated solvent. So the membrane interface probe, you can kind of tell when you're in a D-NAPL just by a very intense reading on your NIP probe, but with the dye-life tool that Dakota Technologies has just come out with, you would actually be able to detect that L-NAPL or D-NAPL, because that's only that it's looked, it's the only thing that it senses is actual free phase product, whether it's just beads of NAPL that you have or an actual NAPL layer. So there are lots of tools that give us both the geology, the matrix distribution, as well as the contaminant distribution, and a wide array of sensors out there. So the next slide.
You want to try to click through since you were able to see this one? Let's see if those arrows are working.
Yeah, maybe I can now. Be nice.
There you go.
Okay. All right, that did work. So the power of direct sensing and high resolution. I'm almost done with these overview slides, but, you know, the nice thing about high resolution, you know, oftentimes when we have these problems, you know, we'll put in maybe 20 soil borings and get an idea where our contaminant is up in the top of the vadose zone. Where we find it, we may sink a well. At this particular thing, you see our main release is right underneath that forklift or under the pallet that the forklift is holding. So if we advanced a well down into the subsurface, the saturated zone there, we wouldn't see anything. So that might be one of our well points, and we may put a couple downstream or one at the back of the property and really not see much of a problem down in the saturated zone. But with high resolution characterization, you know, we're not talking about 20 soil borings and three wells, maybe five wells, or two or three nested wells. We're actually looking at putting many borings in. Typically what we'll do is we'll go out to a site and we'll advance a boring from surface to refusal, maybe on 50-foot intervals, going all across the site or all around the building to find exactly where we're finding contamination. And when we do find that contamination, we go in and we'll put more borings. Now, these are all in a straight line, obviously, on this visual, but, you know, you'll grid them out, you'll find where this contamination is, and you'll put as many borings in that you possibly can, or that you need to truly understand the resolution and the density, the spatial distribution of this contaminant. Now, this looks like a lot of borings that I just put across here on this particular site. And, of course, this is not to scale, but that's just 20 borings. Generally, on one of these sites, in a relatively small footprint, I like to put a minimum of 20 borings and oftentimes up to 40 borings. Vertically, we get massive amounts of information. Again, as I was mentioning earlier, every half centimeter in cases with a MIP probe, every foot you're getting a contaminant reading. So you're with an HPT, you're getting it on a per inch basis. So you're getting a massive amount of vertical data. Your resolution and your accuracy is really dependent on how many borings you put in the ground. That's what's giving you that clear three-dimensional photograph. So if you only have, let's call it, 20 pixels, you'll have a lot of interpolation between those borings. If you put in 40 borings, or let's call them pixels, so you want a clear picture, you will have a much clearer understanding of what's in the subsurface. Again, that matrix distribution as well as the contaminant distribution. So these high-resolution investigations have really had a profound effect on the accuracy of conceptual site models. Again, we get these very dense vertical data sets. Our accuracy really depends on the horizontal sets. And again, the beauty of this that I mentioned earlier is the electronic data capture is in real time. So I don't need to be in the field if I don't have to be. I still get that information in real time. It can be sent, electronically, uploaded to a file share or a database of some sort, so you have access to this information regardless of where you are. So all stakeholders can get it. We can immediately share that data. People can evaluate it on their own. You can do that on site. You can do it remotely. It's completely transparent. All of the stakeholders are getting the data as it's generated. This is something that I think a lot of people have asked for many years. And then I think the best thing is that we can fill the data gaps while we're still in the field. Let's argue the conceptual site model while we still have the field crew there and can evaluate those data gaps in real time. Let's don't argue a report, 6 to 8 months later, because again, remember that 6 to 8 months just cost us $1 million if our contaminant is migrating into a new medium like a vadozone to groundwater. Let's argue that in real time while we're out there and all get on the same page. And they're wonderful arguments to have. I use the word argument, but they are wonderful sessions to have when everybody is arguing their point in real time, trying to develop a conceptual site model, because eventually the team, and we've worked through this, the team has an aha moment where we get it, and everybody gets it. And no longer are we arguing about a report or a conceptual site model or data gaps or things that we should have done. Now we're arguing about what we can do to solve the problem, and that is in real time, the first mobilization out on a project. When do you get a chance to do that? It's usually a year or two later, doing it the old way. So there's a lot of power in this. Again, high collaborative nature of this type of technology, and you get a very high confidence in your problem set and what your next actions ought to be. So let's just talk a bit about pragmatic remediation opportunities. A good friend of mine and colleague at EPA has, used to tell me that a lot of people will argue, and a lot of people do argue, that every site's a snowflake. And of course we all know that every site has its nuances. But again, when it comes to remediation and the technologies that we know about and 35 years of Superfund experience that we have a pretty good idea of what it is we need to do, what our options are if we've got an accurate conceptual site model. So while it might be nice to study each and every snowflake on a site, when at the end of the day, we're either going to shovel it, we're going to snow blow it, or we're going to plow it. So, sometimes these are the shades of gray. There's only so much we really need to know to solve the problem. So an important part about remediation, at least from my point of view. And I'll tell you a quick story here from a remediation contractor point of view. So lots of times we bid these lump sum projects, and a big project would come down the pike. And of course, we all get excited about a nice opportunity. You spend a lot of time sales and marketing, and finally an opportunity comes down the line. And you want it, and you want it badly. But then you say, well, it's going to cost us an awful lot of money to bid this job. These proposals take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and then you start asking, okay, who else is going to bid this job? And generally, it's two or three of your strongest competitors. So now you know you're not going to get the job sole source, so you have to invest this time and money. And lots of these projects will come with massive amounts of bid specs. They'll come with an RI, you know, hundreds of pages of documents from assessments and remediations and things like that. The bid specs that you have to comply with, and usually there's a clause in the proposal that if you don't answer the mail, if you don't bid what is asked of you, you're disqualified. So you have to bid it. Now, you know, when there are very prescriptive specifications that you have to bid to, that everybody's got these identical specifications. So you'll ask your salesperson, well, how are we going to win this job? And the salesperson answer inevitably is, well, lowest price. The problem with lowest price is there may not be any margin in that lowest price. Or if we forgot something, we could spend a year, maybe 2 years on a project or more and end up losing money at the end of the day. So that's a risky proposition. So how do you win these jobs? And this is where we landed, at least on two firms where I worked, and it works. The way you win these projects is you have to answer the mail, but because you don't want to win it that way, on a very low margin job where you may have forgotten something and will end up losing money, the way you win it from a profit margin point of view, number one, and number two, from a value point of view to your, both your company and your client, you come up with a better approach. So what we would always do is we would look through the documents and understand, what did the engineering firm not know that we know? You know, what do we do every day and know about these sites as a remediation firm that the engineering firm may not know? And when you find those things, that's the basis of your new approach to get better value, a higher margin for your company, and a better approach for your client. Now, this is not always the case, you know, but if it is the case, and more often than not, we found a better way. So my question is this. I know there are a lot of consulting and engineering firms on the line, so don't take this the wrong way, because there are plenty of times when we need that consulting and engineering and we need those specifications. But oftentimes when you win the job as a construction contractor, you win it by coming up with a different approach entirely. What does that say about the value and the time of all of those bid specs for the approach that ultimately wasn't used? So there are reasons to go to firms to do a design build for you. You know, so I'll leave it at that. We'll move to the next slide.
Tom, just a quick time check. We have just over an hour left.
Thank you, Jean. So here's a spill. We found with our high-resolution characterization, we had in this particular picture, and this is a simplistic picture, a vadose zone with a few clay stringers. The darker the lens, the denser, the lower permeability of the soil type. So our material was resting on a clay lens. On the edges of it, it ran down to the water table, you know, but, you know, could we put a vapor extraction system in here to control these vapors right away in this type of formation? Yes, you can. You might need to do a field pilot test, like I said, so you can have an optimal spacing. But with this conceptual site model, you know exactly where your contaminant is. You understand the permeability of the subsurface. You can control those vapors and eliminate this vapor intrusion problem over at these homes over to the right by controlling the vapors on the source. You'll also accomplish a lot of mass removal of that contaminant in that area. So you're attacking immediately that 98%. Where you still had a high mass going down into the saturated zone, again, in this type of formation, you put a couple sparge points right in the heart of these plumes that are going down into the subsurface and attack that mass as well. You already have the vapor extraction system up top to control the vapors so that you don't have vapors in your building and you don't have vapors going into these homes. So you eliminated two major risks and major cost factors. And then you find out, well, hey, we do have problems down in the saturated zone. In this particular situation, you could put sparge points in, and these are very cost-effective, very quick to design, build and install and operate types of systems that controls this source area and removes that mass, and you're attacking the 98%. In this sort of formation, you could also use injection. That would work quite well. Up top, where you have that clay lens and a lot of that material residing on it, you could certainly excavate that and get that out if you wanted to, unless, of course, it's under your building, which is a difficult thing to do. So that's why oftentimes vapor extraction and sparging, you know, below the water table is a great way to get it out, or injection if you can get that contact with the air, or if you're injecting a material to treat it, you know, get that contact with the contaminant with your injectant. Again, you're controlling that 98% very quickly, very cost effectively. This can save you millions of dollars in the end, because you will not just get rid of 2 pounds in this long dilute plume, but you can get rid of your 98 pounds that is the source of this overall problem. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the membrane interface probe, hydraulic profile tool. Let's get into one of these technologies. So here's a membrane interface probe that you see over to the right, and it looks like everything's working for me now. Hopefully it still will. At the bottom of these probes, you have an electrical conductivity dipole array. What that will do is will tell you, this is where it is, it'll tell you if you have a high EC reading, electrical conductivity, you're typically in a fine-grained soil. You're also typically in a higher clay content soil, and that seems to be more true than just whether or not it's fine-grained soils or not. You can be a very tight sand, and it could be very fine-grained sand, but sand is silicon, and that's not conductive, so you'll get a low EC reading. But typically when you're in a clay, you'll get a high EC reading with these things. And when you have a low EC reading, you're in a coarse-grained soil or a silt, or not a silt, but a sand, or a gravel type situation. So you get that sort of information with the probe for geology. Original VIP probes, this was the only geology information that you got. But back in about, I think it was 2009 or so, they added a hydraulic profiling tool to it too, where you inject water in the formation out of this port that you see circled. There's a port, and you inject water into the formation as you advance the probe, at about 3 milliliters per second. So it's not a lot of water, but you're measuring two things. You know, what is the back pressure from trying to inject that water into the formation, and what is my flow rate? So you're trying to keep this constant 3 mil per second flow rate and measuring your back pressure. And when you get into a clay area, you'll obviously get a high back pressure because you can't inject into that tight silt or clay. And if you're in a sand and gravel, you'll get a very low back pressure and a high flow rate. So this gives you very, very good ideas of what your permeability behaviors are as you advance this probe through the subsurface. So you can see very specific lenses and what the permeability behaviors are. On the other side of the probe, you have a heat plate about 6 inches long and about 2 inches, maybe an inch, inch and a half wide. And it heats the subsurface, and that's soil and water next to it, to 120 degrees Celsius. So the plate's kept at that temperature. So, you know, you volatilize off any of your VOCs in the subsurface. And a portion of them will pass through this membrane, this semipermeable membrane. There is a stainless steel tube that runs down the trunk line of this probe and across this membrane space and carries those volatiles up to the surface where we have a bank of instruments. So this is the trunk line. We have the inner working. So we have a thermocouple on that heat plate to know we're at the right temperature. We have the electronics down to the dipole array for the electrical conductivity. We have our water line and transducers to measure our water flow and our back pressure of the water, and the stainless steel tube that sweeps the nitrogen gas past the membrane interface so that we can pull those vapors that have been volatilized up to the surface. This is a set of rods for the geoprobe that are strung with that the orange trunk line that contains all of these wires and probes that I just talked about. And, of course, that is advanced by the geoprobe that you have with the driller in the background. The support van for a MIP, M-I-H-P-T van, is typically, you know, one of these Sprinter-type vans. They work really well. Inside these vans, you have a bank of lab-grade instruments that my green pointer is in front of. So You usually have a photoionization detector, flame ionization detector, an electron capture detector, and a halogen-specific detector. And we'll talk about each of those detectors and what they do in just a little bit. Up above that, you'll see the instruments that control all of the trunk line instrumentation. And you'll usually have a flat screen display so that you can see the boring logs in real time as you advance your probe in the subsurface. Now let's talk about some of these boring logs. This is where I get into the nitty-gritty a little bit. So here are eight logs that are typically produced with each boring. And these went down to about 50 feet before we hit refusal. I'm going to go through each one in some level of detail just to give you an idea of what they show us. And I know it's hard to read, so I have little captions that will come up here and tell you. So this first one in brown is the maximum HPT reading. So this is our back pressure on that measured by our transducer from the injection port where we're injecting water into the formation. You'll see at this particular probe, you know, we see these lower permeability lenses. So these are areas of higher back pressure. So we see one at the top where it's about 5 to 15 feet deep where we're seeing some significant back pressures. It's only going up to about 40 PSI, which is not incredibly high. Usually if we get up to about 50 PSI, we're getting into a tight silt or maybe a clay layer. If we get up to 100 PSI, we're in a clay that stops things. So you get a feel for this. This one typically around 20 PSI. We have one of these spikes that gets up to 40, but generally you're in about the 20 PSI range. So to me, I'm wondering, okay, I've got contaminant there, but is that something maybe I could get air through to do air sparging? So, you know, that is if contaminant's hanging up in that zone. So you see below that at about 20 feet, we have just a very slight lens of some, you know, lower permeability material. And then down at the bottom, we've got, you know, another lens with some increases in back pressure. But by and large, this is a pretty permeable saturated zone here. So not much back pressure here at all. You'll see that these blue or these black triangles, okay, are what we're measuring here at this bottom scale or the aqua colored scale is the piezometric pressure, so the hydraulic head at the water table. And what we'll do periodically as you advance that hydraulic profile tool down in the formation is you'll just stop the water flow and run a dissipation test. And when you do that, you'll get a measurement of the actual hydraulic head. And of course, we know that that is a linear function. It's just a function of how high or how tall that water table head is. So we'll get a linear a line from all of our dissipation measurements. So you need to take at least two. In this case, we took four, and you extrapolate that back to your y-axis, and that tells you where your water table is. So two things with just this probe. We found out what our water table depth is, getting back to the 10 things we hope that we can find out, you know, on site so we can make good decisions is where is our water table? And what is the permeability of the various lenses that we have in this 50-foot column of soil in the vadose zone and saturated zone? And that's our water table extrapolation. This next thing I won't spend any time on, this is the flow rate. And really the only thing you're looking for with the flow rate, when you see an increase in your back pressure, you ought to see a drop in your flow rate. That's how you know that the tool is operating properly. And if you're not seeing this correlation, this mirror image, so to speak, then something's wrong. You might have a clogged line or something like that. So you're always measuring your flow. You're measuring your back pressure. But it's that back pressure that's giving you an idea of the permeability or lack of permeability of these different soil lenses. And the flow rate, to me anyway, is making sure that the instrument is working properly. There's nothing clogging the lines. This third boring log is nothing more than just subtracting out the hydraulic head, the hydrostatic head, so that we can compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges. So, you know, while our highest back pressure areas were down at the 50-foot level, most of that was hydraulic head. Once we subtract out the hydraulic head, you'll see that that's a higher permeability zone than this zone that we had up at the 5 to 15-foot range. This next boring log right here is just something that GeoProbe calculates in their software. So from doing lots of testing and lots of sites over the years, they have an algorithm that determines what your estimated hydraulic conductivity is of these particular zones, and it's based on this flow rate and back pressure. Not surprisingly, if you have a high back pressure, you have a low hydraulic conductivity. If you have a low back pressure and a high flow, you have a high hydraulic conductivity. This gray boring log is the electrical conductivity readings. So these are millisieverts per meter, and it's just a measurement of conductance in the soil from one of your electrodes to the other on either side of the probe. And you'll see up in the top area where we had that higher zone of, or that lower permeability zone, you know, we're seeing that as a low conductivity reading. So that indicates that you have, a coarse grain material. So you should have a higher permeability in that area. You might have a higher EC reading there, and we don't. And the reason we don't at this particular site, that was more of a sand and gravel or interbedded slight silts and sand. So, you know, we were getting a low conductivity reading because there really was no clay content at that material. But as we got deeper in the formation, we had actually, you know, some permeability, low permeability zones down at that 50-foot level. And you see with these higher EC readings, we had a much higher clay content as we got deeper into that formation. So, you know, these two things, the HPT along with the EC, tells you a lot about your formation. Now, you need to take a core, you know, here and there to truth check this stuff. So you don't just take it at face value, but you can get a very good idea of what's going on just by looking at these boring logs. And after you've done a number of them, then you decide, okay, this is where we want to take a sample and really figure out what is this lens, what is this zone, what's going on in that particular area. This next boring log is an XSD. And that's our halogen-specific detector, so it's only going to look for chlorinated solvents. That's all it will detect, or any kind of halogenated material, but typically in our field we're looking for chlorinated solvents. This is output is in microvolts. All of these detector, contaminant detector readings are in microvolts, and they're all on a logarithmic scale, so this is a 10 to the 4th. And in my experience, when you have a reading at 10 to the 4th, which is 10,000 to up to 100,000, you're in pretty low contaminant areas. So this, while we seem to see responses as this is advancing, this is really just a background reading here. You know, where if I could try to read this, it looks like it goes up to maybe 70,000 or so. You know, and these are very low readings for an XSD, and that's really just background. We're not seeing chlorinated solvents at this particular boring. This next final boring log is our FID, and the green, that's the purple, and the green is our PID. The microvolt readings here were at 10 to the 7th. So we were at, let's see, 1 times 10 to the 7th, so we're at 10 million microvolts. That's a very significant reading. That is clearly, from our experience, residual source hung up in that low permeability zone, which also kind of happens to be the smear zone at this particular site. So we are seeing significant residual source up in that lower permeability zone. We have a pretty good match with the PID, the green, and the purple are matching well. So we're getting two lines of evidence that we have this contaminant. Sometimes these two things will not read and correspond. We might have a methane pocket or some other sort of problem or another contaminant altogether where one instrument detects that contaminant and the other doesn't, particularly if you might have a very high ionization potential type chemical that the PID doesn't separate, doesn't ionize, the plain ionization detector will detect it. In this case, they're both detected by these things and both at high levels. Our PID reading was up at 10 to the 6th, but it was at 5 times 10 to the 6th. So we're at 5 million microvolts for our PID, and we're up to 10 million microvolts with our FID. So what we like to call this area where we have this low permeability zone over at the far left with this silt and sand layer hanging up these hydrocarbons, you know, that's our mass storage zone. So we're calling this a mass storage zone. And the mass storage zones we find in the subsurface with these tools are generally 100 to 1,000 times higher than what we see in the transport zone, which I'm going to show you in just a little bit. Down here at the bottom, again, you know, again, we have a little bit of low permeability zone, higher clay content material. We're not seeing anything with the PID and the FID at this particular area. Excuse me, I'm sorry. The question is why? I'm sorry, the question is why? What's probably going on there is there is contamination down at that depth, but, excuse me, one second. I apologize. But when we get down to that layer, while we might have contamination, we don't have it at the 10 million range, at the 10 to the 7th range, or high to the 10 to the 6th. It might be 10 to the 5th, 100,000, or 500,000, which will not show up on this scale. So there's one thing that can fool you a lot of times on these things. You'll see, well, gee, we have contamination up at the surface, but everything's clean for the next 45 feet down. It's not. It doesn't show up on that scale. So you can dial these scales down to 10 to the 5th. Your peaks at the top will flatline, you know, because they'll be off the charts. But then you'll be able to see what your peaks are as you advance this probe down to the subsurface at the lower concentration level. So don't let it fool you that everything is clean just down below. It's just you're on a scale where those peaks are not showing up. Okay, here's the same set of borings, but I've mixed them up just to confuse everybody. I put the one set on the left and the other set on the right. But, you know, what I'm trying to show with this is if you look at this particular area, this is a mass transport zone, what we're calling a transport zone. So you'll see our main peak with the PID, and we're seeing a similar peak with the FID, not as pronounced, but we've got this nice sloping peak, if you will, in this particular zone. We're below that area up above where you see we had, you know, some hits up at that same 5 to 10 foot level, and we have a little bit of back pressure hit up in that area. So we've got a little bit of mass stored up in that area, but this is farther down at this particular site, and we're in the dissolved phase plume area, and this is a transport zone. So we're seeing low permeability, no back pressure readings on our HBT, and this peak in the area. There's our slight storage zone up there, but much lower than the slide before. But look at the scales on these things. We're at 2 times 10 to the 5th in this transport zone, so we're at 200,000 versus 500,000, or no, 5 million to 10 million. Down below with the PID, we're actually at 6 times 10 to the 4th, or 60,000. So, you know, we're much lower. Again, orders of magnitude lower than we were in these mass transport zones. And this is something that we see time and time again. Again, getting back to where is the mass residing, it is almost always with insoluble compounds, the 99.9% compounds. They're almost always in a silt zone or a clay zone or some sort of stringer trying to hide out from the water. And what we see in the water is that order of magnitudes lower. This becomes important when you remediate. If we're trying to inject and we inject into the transport zone, into this high permeability zone, we can clean that plume up like nobody's business. And why? Because there's virtually no mass in that plume. So if we've evaluated this site using monitoring wells and all of our data is groundwater data and we find out where the high concentrations are in the groundwater, we have orders of magnitude higher in these silt zones. They're our root cause zones. We can clean up the groundwater, and then because diffusion is a very, very slow process, we find a year later, 2 years later, our problem is coming back. And we call that matrix diffusion, which is a nice fancy term. It's exactly what's happening. We're getting back diffusion, you know, out of that matrix. But another thing you could call it is we treated the wrong medium. We should have treated the high mass medium, not the diffusion medium. Yeah, this is just a classic slide. Once again, we've got a bunch of boring logs here. You'll see the high HBT reading at this first log to the left. We get low flow rate in the navy blue, so our instrument's working well. Subtract the hydraulic head. Let me just move this as well. You know, we get low hydraulic conductivity here. Our EC reading is saying, yeah, you know, we're probably in a clay zone in this particular area. That's why it's such a high back pressure and low permeability. And sure enough, here's our hydrocarbon hanging up in that particular zone. We don't have any chlorinated solvent at this particular thing. So this is a very classic mass storage zone area. Down here, we're seeing some readings with the PID. Okay, we're not seeing anything with the FID. This doesn't seem to be a scale issue because the PID is certainly seeing hits. So, you know, what is going on in this particular area? And you know, I'd have to say I really don't know. So this might be an area that you'd go down and take a sample or take a core and find out what's going on in there, because it doesn't seem to be matching what we're seeing at other borings. So let's talk about a site. Time check, where are we, Gene? We've got 40 minutes left, right?
So Tom, you've got about 40 minutes left total.
Yeah, and we want to have questions and answers. So I'm going to go through, let me go through this particular case study, unless we've had enough questions and you think we ought to stop for a minute now, Gene. What do you think?
Well, let's go ahead and take just one of these questions. Okay. I think some of them will be relevant.
Said a lot.
To a case study. So one of these questions that came in from the participants, because you've been talking so much of all of these tools and the high-density data sets, is there a sense or a problem with data overload? How do you store and manipulate and understand the mass of this data to produce conceptual site models?
You know, that used to be a problem. And, you know, back even just a few years ago, the computers weren't powerful enough to deal with it. You know, these days, most decent PCs will handle this data. Now, when you're running the programs and the data visualization and things like that, you do need a powerful PC. But, I mean, this is nothing like, you don't need supercomputers or anything like that. The people that we work with do a lot of visualization with us. You know, pretty much have a PC that's kind of like a gamer's PC. You know, it might cost $4,000 or $5,000 versus, you know, our typical laptops at maybe $700, and they can crunch these things. They can crunch all this data quite well. But that's a valid question. It is a massive amount of data. But these days, we have the storage capacity. And with computers that we have and the processors, rarely do we have a problem processing the data.
Okay. And I think you're going to get in later on and show us some examples of some of the tools that can help them process and visualize this massive amount of data, correct?
Yeah, we will. We will. Okay. And this case study in particular. I wanted to give you the backdrop. And I'm sorry, you know, we haven't gotten into case studies, and everybody loves case studies the most. But without the backdrop and going through those logs and understanding, you know, when we do 20 borings on a very small footprint, you know, what are we seeing with those 20 borings? Because what I'm going to show you here is this three-dimensional visualization. And when you start off with that, you know, the first thing that comes to everybody's mind is, well, how can I believe that? You can believe that when that matches what you're seeing in excruciating detail with every one of these borings. And taking a boring and moving down 25 feet later, and you say, here comes the clay lens, and this is the beauty of these tools. You know, you see a clay lens, and you see a contaminant hung up in a clay lens, and you move 20 feet down, or 25 feet down, let's say, and you know you're getting to 17 feet, we ought to be seeing this clay lens, and you see the clay lens again, and boom, you have a higher hit with your PID and FID or XSD, and you move down another 25 feet, and eventually you move out of the area. You say, well, that was it, at least along that transect. And you'll back away maybe 15, 25, 30 feet, and you'll run another transect, and you'll get into it, and you'll get out of it. And then you'll move that transect either farther upstream or farther downstream. And suddenly, you know, you've gone into this contaminant and out of it and the geology, and you're predicting in advance what you're going to see. And then when you get surprised, it's like, well, the geology fell apart on me here. You know, that lens is no longer here, and my contaminant's no longer here. What happens with a chlorinated lots of times is that's where you see it at 40 feet because there's nothing to hang it up anymore. So that's what we'll talk about a little bit with this case study. I like this case study. It's not an NPL site. It's a site that could be an NPL site, and, you know, if we wait long enough, you know, maybe it will be an NPL site. And the reason I say that is we have a dry cleaner here, very small. Okay, this is a 200-foot by 200-foot property, this red-roofed building. This dry cleaner went out of business in the 1960s. So the problem is pretty much there. You know, we're not catching this as it spilled. This thing probably spilled decades ago. We knew that there was contamination because a contractor had gone in here, a consultant, and they did a few MIP borings. They did 11 borings in this two-block area here. So they did do some work, and we knew that there was a real hot spot by the dry cleaner. We knew we had very high groundwater concentrations, again, you know, right by that dry cleaner. And we knew that, if you look at this next slide over here, 1,800 feet away, we have a municipal well in another state, mind you. This divider line right here, this street right here, divides Delaware and Maryland. So 1,800 feet, we have a municipal well that's impacted by chlorinated solvents, you know, tetrachloroethylene from the dry cleaner, at about 2 or 3 parts per billion. So Delaware, I believe, is still 5 ppb is their MCL. So they're below MCL. They are treating it with either carbon or air stripping. I'm not sure what the water authority is using. But they're spending a lot of money. They're talking about putting in a new municipal well that would be deeper, that won't be impacted. But again, we have this plume going 1,800 feet. We suspect. We've never confirmed and connected these two, but it's pretty apparent 1,800 feet is not very far in a sand and gravel type aquifer from this dry cleaner. So could this be an NPL site? Municipal well impact, multiple states, an abandoned dry cleaner from decades ago. So yeah, it could be. So we were asked to go out there mainly for vapor intrusion issues and to see if we truly had a source area at this dry cleaner and if we maybe had other source areas from other former dry cleaners in this particular town. That was our charge. So what we did is we kind of pummeled this area around the dry cleaner with 20 borings. Again, what we did is right around the building. We started at this corner of the building. We went right up this side, and we went right down that side, and then we backed off a little bit in this area because the hot spot's where you see the hot spot. And then we backed up in this area closer to homes to see if we still saw a problem. And then we went this way to see if we still saw a problem. And then we completed our circle around the other corners of the building. And from all of our readings, we did none through the floor in the building. We were planning to, but we decided we really didn't need to because we did so many. Here was our hot spot. And if you look at it, this is a 3D visualization that we could spin around and do that. I don't do it because the technology usually clogs up when we're on Adobe Connect with so many people. But this is a look at it right here. I'm sorry, I'm using my personal mouse. Right here. There's our potato in space. That is our high mass zone. And what we're looking at here, if you look down below, in fact, I might even have things calling this out. Yeah. Okay, so our soil volume. The beauty of this type of program, you know, we're seeing all of our information, you know, on one depiction here. So we're seeing a plan view up above of our really hot plume core. When we look at that soil volume, this is MVS, a mining visualization software. It's put out by a firm called CTEC, and a number of consulting firms are able to use this visualization to give you these sort of 3D images. Again, you can spin this around and turn it upside down and look at it from all sorts of angles. But, you know, a lot of firms now have the capability to do this using this software. So what we see, this high plume core right here is about 600 cubic yards. 580 cubic yards is the mass calculation. And our average XSD reading, that's this halogen-specific detector, is over 500,000 microvolts. So we kind of use that as a cutoff. So when we're at 500,000, we're at something pretty hot. Now, we were at really hot concentrations. These are all color-coded. You'll see some of these cores in here, you know, went up to 10 to the 7th. So we probably have NAPL in those areas. And here's our scale, our microvolt scale over here. So, and these little balls that you see down at the bottom just indicates what your highest reading was in a particular boring. So you get a good idea of what your highest readings are. You can kind of see where you see some of these readings. And then, of course, the software will tell you where your hot plume core is. So to me, that's the 98% mass right there. There are highest readings within those borings. And you saw from the previous slides all the information we see from all of these boring logs. So we ask ourselves, does this look real based on what we saw? And, yeah, it does look real based on what we saw. Because what did we see? We saw a mass storage zone. For some reason, out in Delaware, the coastal plains of Delaware, there is this 10 to 15-foot thick clay lens right underneath this dry cleaner. And is like a godsend. It has hung up most of that chlorinated solvent up in that particular clay lens, and it's not that deep, okay, below the building. So to me, that was a real godsend. So we're seeing our geology. That's the magenta color over here, and here are our HPT readings. We're in this bright magenta. We're in a very high, dense clay area. We're at 100 psi, okay? So that stops most things. And this chlorinated solvent is hung up in that clay lens. When we get down into this light blue here, we're in a transport zone completely, almost no back pressure whatsoever. So this, we're in that truly that sandy aquifer that is leading to the municipal well. As we went down, you know, toward the south here, up in this particular part of the site, up in this area, we saw that this clay lens started falling apart on us. So again, we kept seeing, oh, we're going to see that clay lens again. But as we headed about 100 feet south, it just broke apart, and there was no lens. And that's how we started end up seeing contamination down at about the 40-foot level. Also, we saw some just saturated straight through that lens as well. Okay, so this plume core is at an average response of 62,000. So this is, we're looking at 10 to the fourth microvolts, 6 times 10 to the fourth microvolts. These were our lower readings in the MIP zone. And just from experience, you can't take my word for this. Don't take my word for anything. You know, find this out yourselves. But when we get down to the 10 to the fourth, we're getting close to MCLs. We're certainly in areas where we're probably not going to do any remediation. If we do a proper job deeper in this plume core than that, this should attenuate away. So we use the cutoff at this 10 to the 4th, 6 times 10 to the 4th, for what I would call the buffer zone. So you can go in and dig out. You know, if I've got chlorinated solvent under a tiny abandoned building that nobody wants, frankly, knock the thing down, dig out that clay lens, and you can get rid of probably 90% of the mass just with that. Okay, pretty low-tech, you know, remediation approach, but when do you get a clay lens like that under a building that really nobody wants? In fact, the town wants to redevelop this area, so it's a perfect opportunity to knock that thing down, dig this contamination out, but you can take care of that. We had, you can see right here, by the shape of this plume, we had breakthrough through this clay lens. So it didn't hold everything. It did saturate. It did break through. And you see, once it does break through, by the shape of the plume, it all starts moving toward that municipal well. The well is up here about 1,800 feet to the north. And we're looking at it from the east, looking west. And we did have a slight low permeability zone down here that did seem to stop its vertical flow in that particular area. So, you know, what might we do in this particular zone once we're outside of the clay? You know, injection might be a perfectly fine thing to do. If you excavate away that clay layer where you have that hot spot, you might be able to do tent and sparge in that particular area too, depending on the media that you backfill it with. So we have options. We have very good options to eliminate the potential of an MPL site down the road. So again, you know, our plume core here is 12,000 cubic yards. That's what I would call the buffer zone. A little too big to dig up cost effectively. Might be a perfect thing to deal with injection or maybe vent and sparge if that clay layer were modified or removed, but injection might be the perfect remedial technology in this area. You'll see we have much lower, orders of magnitude lower responses with our MIP. So we do have contamination, but much, much lower concentrations. We've got a transport zone down in this particular area, low back pressure with our HPT, and our storage zone is up above in that clay zone. So again, we call that the buffer zone. So what would we do with this particular thing? I pretty much have already given you my opinion with the story. You know, we see the high mass zone. That's our root cause area. We're fortunate we have a clay lens holding most of it up, so we certainly have options to extract that mass. You know, with a number of ways, excavation probably the easiest of all. We do have symptoms. If we don't deal with it, we have vapor intrusion. We have a migrating plume from what has broken through that clay layer and is headed toward the municipal well. We have municipal well impacts. We have a water authority looking to put in more wells, you know. So there are a lot of costs that are going to be occurring. We could investigate that entire plume if we want, I did a calculation, a rough calculation. You know, we have ounces at the most in that plume headed to the municipal well, and we have many, many pounds up in this high mass zone. So what would you do first? Let's focus on that 2%. We have a municipal well pumping at 500 GPM. You know, we have our treatment system in place. They have carbon or sparging on their well system. Now, if we can just get rid of the source, they could pump that aquifer out in probably a matter of months, and we'd start seeing, you know, very significant attenuation and see this problem go away. Still have to address that buffer zone. You can't just do the excavation. Here's the thing. We'll go down to the very last bullet because I know we're starting to run short of time, and I want to leave time for questions. We go down to this last bullet. We did 40 borings in all in 5 days. We got down there on Monday morning. We got a half day in Monday. We left about 2 o'clock on Friday. We put 40 borings in. 20 of them were right here around this building so that we really got a clear idea of what was going on there. There was a laundromat that we thought may have had a dry cleaner one day right across the street here. We put 5 borings in there to see if maybe they were a contributor, another source. We saw absolutely nothing. We had another dry cleaner that was to the south here. We put 3 borings on their properties to refusal, saw nothing whatsoever. And there was another property, another block to the south. And we put a few wells in there just to see if we saw anything in the subsurface and saw nothing whatsoever either. So we somewhat ruled out other sources. You can't just do 3 borings. You know, that's the low-res approach. But we saw enough to indicate we absolutely have a bona fide source here that needs to be dealt with. And the other suspect areas, we saw absolutely nothing. So, you know, pretty much we came to our conclusions of what to do. So to me, here's the end of the day story. 5 days, we spent $65,000. That was to draft up our plan for what we were going to do, do a quality assurance project plan. That cost about $5,000. We had our markout, geophysical markout people, so that we did utility markout people the entire time we were down there. So we had to pay them, and this is something you have to do with these tools. If you air knife for the first 5 feet, you're not going to see any volatiles with a MIP. Okay, there are none to see because you strip them out with the air knife. So I like to go from surface down, but if you're going to do that sort of thing, you really need to make sure you have no subsurface utilities. You can certainly pre-clear, and many companies, that is their protocol to do that, and for very good reason to do that. So you can pre-clear, you just lose your first 5 feet of data. So you have to get that data another way because you can't volatilize these contaminants and then expect to see anything with the MIP at that point on. So we had our MIP crew for a week. We did 40 borings. All of those borings went down to 50 to 60 feet in general. A very productive week. Came up with a remedial strategy. We confirmed a source. We understand the geology. We understand the permeability. We understand where the high mass zone is for $65,000 in 5 days. It's just amazing. And this is a small site, but how many times do we spend so much more money and so much more time to find out just a fraction of what we found out in 5 days in this site? So that's the power of this particular technology. And now a little bit about the power of the sharing platforms. I was going to cut to a platform, but I'm going to come back to that, Gene. I want to talk about this quickly. I've showed you simplistic sites. I tried to get the RPM for this particular site. This is Wyckoff Eagle Harbor in Washington State. It's a former creosote site. Dakota Technologies was out there using the Targos system for that because it was creosote. They have the only tools for that. They have the exclusive rights to Targos. They developed it. But for this particular site, there were, again, more than a decade worth of information. The old conceptual site model showed the plain view of the contour map. So it was a 12-acre site with a hot core and a plume moving to the perimeter of the site. There's a sheet pile wall put along that entire perimeter of the site. This is out on Bainbridge Island in Puget Sound. The cleanup costs were projected to be $200 million for this particular site. They decided to go with high-resolution characterization using TARGAS. They were out there for about 3 weeks, put in 200 borings. And by doing those 200 borings, what you see here is where that contamination is really. We're not showing you the geology, but you can well imagine that this creosote is hung up in these long permeability zones across the site. That's the true volume of the contaminant and where the 98% mass resides. So it's not an easy problem, okay? You found the 98%. Still have to deal with it. It's not the easiest thing in the world to deal with, and you have to divide this site up into a lot of different pieces, which they did. But by doing that and spending the 3 weeks and 200 borings, and I think it costed about $300,000, they took the projected cost to clean this site up from $200 million down to a range of $40 to $80 million. So for $300,000, three weeks of work in the field, there's a lot of visualization work afterwards and a lot of thought put in about how they could optimize the remediation, saved anywhere from $160 to $120 million, $120 to $160 million in the estimated cost of cleanup of this site. So these simple concepts that I've been trying to portray work at the complicated sites as well. I did try to get the RPM to present her site today, but she was, I did it last minute, she wasn't available, but we can always do that. And it's one thing I did want to throw out to the crowd. My email was at the beginning of this presentation. We've done a lot of these projects over the years, and we have a lot of case studies, and a lot of experiences of where things work, and a lot of experiences where things haven't. We're here. We work for all of you. You know, we're public servants. So if you have questions, if you want to try these technologies, if you have questions about them, you want to talk to people who have used them, feel free to contact us and we'll put you in touch with folks. One of the things we're doing under the Superfund task force is we're putting all of our case studies up onto a shareable data platform. So we want to make all of these case studies available to the entire industries. We just started this. We have a goal to kind of have the platform in place by the end of this fiscal year, and we are working on that. I think it'll be a pretty neat thing. You'll get an overview of all of these case studies, what the geology was, what the technology was that we used, where it worked, where it didn't work, and best of all, people you can call to get more information from. So that's coming, again, as part of the Superfund task force. Okay, are conventional assessment techniques necessary? You might, you know, gather from the way I talk about these things. I'm very high on these tools, you know, but do you need conventional techniques? Absolutely you do. You need to quantify what these things are. We're seeing microvolts. We're seeing indications of categories of contaminants, not specific contaminants. So you need to quantify, you know, what is that contaminant, speciate it, and you need to quantify it so that you can do your mass calculations. You need to understand what it is. You need to take cores out of the ground so that you can see, is this truly a clay lens or is it something else? It's very important information to do. But the nice thing that you can do by having this high-resolution conceptual site model, you know exactly where you want to go to take your core. You know exactly where to go to take your water sample, exactly where to go to take your soil sample. You don't have a sampling plan where you say, I want 20 borings, and I'm going to sample at 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet, and 10 feet. A very random approach to finding a problem that you may find or you may not. These things hide out in very, very specific zones. When you already know where those zones are and where things are hiding out, and you want to know what's in that zone and what's in maybe the adjacent transport zone, you know exactly where to go to screen your wells, take your samples, and things like that. So you can save a lot of money at the tail end of your project after you do the high res by optimizing all of your conventional sampling techniques. Some rules of thumbs for this are production rates. You know, for high-resolution characterization using MIP, something pushed with a geoprobe, we find we get about 125 to 150 feet a day. So if your borings are going to be, you know, 30 feet, you'll probably get, you know, 4 to 5 of them in a day. first couple of days you'll get less, last couple of days you'll get more because you get better at it. So that's a good production rate to use as a rule of thumb if you want to figure out how many days you'll have a crew out there. If you're using a cone penetrometer and using LIF or XRF, or you can push a membrane interface probe with a cone penetrometer, you can get a much higher production rate per day because these are very heavy rigs. They push a lot deeper. They push a lot more smoothly. You don't have to hammer. Things don't break as much with a CPT because it's a gentler push with a massive machine. So you get a higher production rate. You get more feet per day. It's hard to get those rigs in tight places, though, because they are big, heavy machines. Typical boring depths. I like to tell people, look, you know, if you're going deeper than 50 feet, you need to think twice. Now, we just did a job, and we're still doing a job, out in Washington State where every boring is 90 to 100 feet deep. So you can get deeper with a geoprobe. We all know that. But oftentimes you'll get heaving sands when you get down to 50 feet, and, you know, things just stop you. So if you have a geology where you can't push, or you'll get refusal at a shallow depth, this is probably not the right technology for you. What are the daily costs? One of these crews, whether it's a CPT with laser-reducing fluorescence technology, or if it's a geoprobe with a MIP unit, MIHPT unit, they're about $5,000 a day for the crew and the equipment. That's typically what they run. So it's pretty good, easy to estimate what they're going to cost you. You'll have your oversight consulting costs. You'll have your travel and lodging and things like that. Not for the crew. That's all on that $5,000 a day. But I bump it up to $7,500. You're going to do visualization. It can be as simple as $5,000. We find that typically we're spending about $15,000 for a pretty good visualization, where we put a lot of thought into it, a lot of time. We've checked it. We've run a few models. We compared it with our boring logs and what our own brains are telling us after seeing all of the borings. Sometimes we want to put all the historical information in. They get up to $25,000, and sometimes maybe up to $50,000 if you have a decade of data that you still think is valid. You can put all your historical information into these same visualization models and have everything in one picture of your site where you have all your data. And that can be incredibly valuable and worth that amount of money in those situations. And 2D visualizations are very easy to do. You can do them on the fly. You can download GeoProbe's DI Viewer, Direct Image Viewer, and you can do them yourselves as the boring logs come in. As long as you can download it onto your computer, it's pretty easy to figure out and do your own transects and see what's going on a log-by-log basis or a transect of logs. So really quite affordable. What I use as a rule of thumb, so I don't, you know, shortchange myself with an estimate, I'm going to say, okay, that's kind of, it's like 10 grand a day, plus I'm going to add in, and that's the markout people too, $10,000 a day, and I'm going to add $15,000 for the visualization, maybe $25,000 if I have a lot to do there, and I'm generally coming in right on budget. Again, that's me. I'm free. You know, my costs don't go in there because I'm, you know, with the government, my salary's paid for. So you have to figure in your consultants' costs and things like that. But for the crew, direct oversight, mark out people, and the visualization work, $10,000 a day, and then add another $15,000 to $25,000, you can get it done for that. Seems like a lot, but you can save a lot of money on a daily rate basis. But boy, you can find out your problems fast and deal with them before they turn into multi-million dollar problems sometimes. So you save yourself a lot of money down the road. Limitations, these are direct push technologies, so you're not going to go into bedrock. If you have cobbles and boulders, you might not want to do it, probably don't want to do it. Some sands are really hard to get through, so you have to know that you can push in that geology. And the way to do that best is to call the local drillers, ask them if they've drilled there, and see if they can, how deep they can push a geoprobe or a CPT in that area. Detection limits. Geoprobe says you've got to be over 100 ppb if you're going to use a MIP. Laser-induced fluorescence, you need actual product, actual oil. So it can just be a droplet, a ganglion, you know, or it could be NAPL, but it's not going to see dissolved. MIP will see dissolved phase. It will see things in the vadose zone, in the saturated zone, in soil, in water. So, you know, they're not compound specific. They do have a number of detectors. You can really, if you know your compounds already from previous investigations, you're good to go. If you don't and you're seeing hits with these units, you've got to take samples and find out what those hits really are. You need to know your subsurface utilities. I can't emphasize that enough, or you can hit lines and cause more problems than you had in the first place. You need qualified subs, and mostly, I believe, because things break. So I look for people that have done this. There are plenty of contractors out here that have done it now. That's not difficult. I do like people that have a lot of experience and know how to keep things going when the probes break. You always want two rod strings going with these units, so when one breaks, you're flipping to the second one, and you can get back to the first one once it's repaired. So things like that. And you need qualified oversight professionals. You know, we go out to these sites with very senior people. The reason is that we're figuring out these problems and the conceptual site models on the fly. So we love to go out with junior people too. You know, this is a great way for them to see things in ways we never could. Now we've got these tools, but let's bring all of our knowledge to the table and let's teach the new generation too. But let's not just throw them out there on their own and let them, you know, not have the benefit of, you know, the experience of very senior people. So we like to send very high qualified people out to these job sites, as well as the new professionals in our field as well. They'll get up to speed very, very quickly with these tools. Okay, so I'm going to just close with this, get back to the Superfund task force. You know, this is kind of what this conversation's about. We've been finding better ways. You know, we're cutting through the regulatory process and working as a team and getting to our decision points collaboratively, not iteratively or sequentially, by, you know, just putting it from one stakeholder to the next, to the next, to the next. Let's all work together as a team. You know, can industry, can the tribes, the states, the technical experts all work together on the same side of the table rather than everybody being on different sides of the table, you know, delaying the project and delaying the ultimate solution. If we can all work together as a team, and it's fun to do, we'll have our debates up front, but I'll tell you, I've worked on some of these teams, and when we get to that aha moment and we all agree on what the issue is, it's a wonderful feeling. So it can be done, and we are doing it. So right now, we don't have policies to this. ITRC is writing guidance as we speak. They just formed the Advanced Site Characterization Tools Committee, so there will be guidance on this coming out. EPA is certainly looking at ways that we can change our approaches and the way that we work with industry and stakeholders to improve the process through this task force. So the conversation's begun. The opportunity is here. And we're trying to spread the word to all of you to take advantage of this and share your thoughts with us and maybe even team with us on some jobs in the future. So here we go. We talked about the direct sensing tools. We talked about some of the advantages of data as a deliverable rather than hard copy reports and how we can collaborate together. Some of the programmatic approaches here, let's begin with the end in mind, get these conceptual site models, you know, using these techniques much more quickly for a lot less money, attack these root causes, protect the receptors in the low mass zones. I'm never advocating not protecting the receptors. That's what we have to do in the dilute areas. But let's see if we can attack the high mass zones, set up the conditions for natural attenuation to be a valid approach to get rid of that residual that might be remaining and move faster through this conventional regulatory process than we have, you know, in the previous three decades or so. Let's see if we can make things better in the decades to come. And I will throw out this one proposition. You know, if there are folks in the audience that do want to identify maybe some appropriate sites, you know, and get together and try to run the four-minute mile, I say, you know, Roger Bannister, nobody thought you could run a four-minute mile until he did. So what we're trying to do is identify those sites where we can actually go out there and prove this concept from start to completion and assess and remediate a site faster than we ever have before, successfully, properly, and run that four-minute mile and then set the stage for the rest of the industry to follow suit. Many people have broken the four-minute mile since he did. Sometimes you just need a group to go out there and actually get it done. So with that, I'm sorry I talked too long. We have a few minutes for questions.
Thank you so very much. So Tom, I think what I'm going to ask you to do is to go ahead and switch out to that screen sharing mode so that we can start to call that up but also start to take some questions. And we'll go through what we can in the time that we have allotted. So this very first question asks, if there is sort of a general rule of thumb for horizontal spacing between some of those points that you were sort of dropping into the subsurface. In other words, the example is, what size hotspot could you miss or and not adversely affect the remaining risk? Are we talking 5 meters, half a meter? Is there a rule of thumb that you use?
Yeah, well, there's not a rule of thumb. I mean, the first thing you want to do is what we always do, you know, read any of your historical information. You know, find out what's known about that site already. Typically, what you do in a PASI, you know, preliminary assessment, site investigation, you know, what did that company do? Where did they do it? And try to zero in on where your problem is, where it's already known, or where it might be. And then depending on the size of your site, that's generally for me, it's like, where do I think that problem is? I typically like to start at the most likely spot. So I'm finding those spots immediately. And then if it's a big site, I'll go on 100-foot intervals. Once I get into some contaminant, I'll go to 50-foot. And if I'm in areas like, hey, we're in it now, let's try to understand exactly what is going on. I may go into 25 footers. So generally I don't get much tighter than 25 feet, but we've done plenty of sites at 25 feet. We generally don't start there. Generally 50 to 100 feet intervals is where I would start.
All right, excellent. You can feel free to call that system up on your screen, because our next question asks if the MIP manufacturers or some of the other manufacturers of tools you were showing have free online guides for interpreting the plots or some way to go through all of that data set that you were showing in some of your case studies or examples. And for those of you who are watching on the screen now, Tom's calling something up live. We're actually looking at his computer screen in real time. If you want to make his screen bigger, I'll encourage the participants, if you look in the upper right corner of the window where his screen appears, there should be a button that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. You can make his screen bigger by clicking that four-arrowed button. If you want to zoom in even further, click the square just to the right of that four-arrow button, and you can go into a full-size scale on your computer. So, Tom, go ahead. We can see your screen.
Great. I'm so glad this is all working here on my end now, so I apologize for before. Okay, so this is a dry cleaner site. Well, another one, okay, and this is the building where they did the dry cleaner right here. It's real fuzzy. You can't see it in the aerials, but we know from previous investigations there were some hot spots in this area, in this particular area. This is a system that Columbia Technologies has. It's their smart data solutions. When they do a boring, their information immediately goes into this online tool. So every time a boring was done, I was in Edison, New Jersey. They were down here in Maryland doing this. I was kind of helping to guide a little bit the investigation and help with the interpretation, but I was not in the field. I couldn't be there, but didn't need to be. Every time a boring was done, I knew when the boring was complete, and I could go into that particular boring. And I could just click on it, and I could see what my highest readings are, or I could double-click on this boring, and it opens up, and there is all of my data. I can unstack that data right here, and here's my PID readings with depth, and as I scroll down here, I'll keep the arrow over to the side, but if I wanted to see, well, what is this peak right here, I can put my cursor on it, and I can see we're at 4.3 million microvolts with the electron capture detector. The next one over is our flame ionization detector right here. So we got a pretty strong peak signal there, again, about 28 feet deep. And this was the electron capture detector. I think I may have misspoke. There was a PID over in this first log. And this is our electrical conductivity log, this brown thing. So you do see my screen live. So this is this brown graph is our electrical conductivity. So that was boring log, boring number one. But then we did, of course, number two, and then number three, and then number four. And what I do, and that easily, I am now looking at an elevation corrected transect of those four borings. and I can see what I thought was a pretty decent hit and boring MO1. When I get to MO2, it's a little deeper. My ECD is maxed out at 12 million microvolts. That sounds high. I'm going to talk about that in just a second. I know there's not much time left. But these ECDs, not the XSD, the halogen-specific detector, this electron capture detector, is also designed for chlorinated solvents. But they max out at maybe 10 to 20 ppm, really low levels. So you'll see a hit like this at 12 million, like, oh, my God, 12 million microvolts. That's, Tom, you told me that's NAPL area, not with the electron capture detector. So I generally don't recommend using these detectors for dry cleaner sites unless you're looking for low, or chlorinated solvent sites, unless you're looking for low concentrations. Because once you get up to 10, 20 ppm, they're going to max out on you. So you see, I have to go back down here to my FID and my PID to see where was this true peak at. You know, it's down here at about 38 feet. The ECD started detecting it way up here at 25 feet, and I might make the improper conclusion that it peaked at 30 feet, but I really have to go to these two detectors that don't max out at that level, and it was about 38 feet deep is where we got our high FID and PID readings. We go over to MO4, which is this boring right here, this third one. We kind of went out of order a little bit. To the previous question, we jumped out at a bigger interval and said, whoops, we're out of it, and we needed to dial back in and hit that gap in between. We see, again, we have another big peak here, but it's not quite as maxed out. Our FID and our PID are at lower concentrations, so our real source is right here. We know homes are impacted by vapor intrusion from this particular site. I can show you all the other borings on this site on this, but there's really not a whole lot to see. This is the heart of it, right here. And the homes down in this area are the ones that are being impacted. And, of course, what are we doing? We're putting subslab systems in to protect them. But when you put a subslab system in, what do? You establish that negative pressure gradient that makes these vapors want to move toward these homes. Now, they have a system on them, so theoretically they're protected. That drives me insane because I want my source material back at the source. I don't want anything to pull it away. So what we've been advocating with the state, and then we're going to do a pilot test out here, is putting in a soil vapor extraction system, a wall, basically, an interceptor vapor extraction system along Winter Street so that we can keep all of this source material back here so that these homes can actually, we can clear out those vapors that are under the homes, not continuously pull vapors to them so they'd have to run these systems forever. So what we're trying to do is keep this source contained and remove the mass, you know, at where the mass is, so that we can clean these homes up and they can get rid of these subslab systems and don't have vapors under their homes anymore. But this is just a quick example, you know, how quickly, you know, if I wanted to look at this transect, boom, I double click them. I'm sorry, I got to double click and clear them. But you all saw, you could.
Yeah.
It's not opening up.
Yeah, I think maybe in the interest right now of time, because we have gone just past our scheduled end time, we'll go ahead and click back to the content and just take one or two more questions live before we close things out today. So there were a number of participants, Tom, who have sort of brought up particular scenarios where the tools that you talked about might not work. So there have been questions about what would you do if you were working with a very large site, or perhaps you had contamination that was too deep, or soils or subsurface conditions where you couldn't drive a geoprobe in there. Do you have any tips or suggestions when you're dealing with these really deep or large sites, or just materials that you can't readily use these tools? Have you used other technologies to make them work?
There are other technologies, but these direct push, direct sensing technologies are really not one. You can do a lot of geophysics, you know, with boreholes and things like that. You know, look, if you have any indication whatsoever in the overburden that that's where your problem might be, and it's just some sort of overburden where you can't drill, you can go to passive soil gas sampling, where you can put these samplers, you know, throughout the site at relatively modest cost, and take them out after a period of time, a month or more, and run them at the lab, and you can find out where you might have vapor concentrations indicating that that might be where you have a source area. We just did work on a bedrock site for a landfill where we had a chlorinated plume, And they did a pump test, and in a well that was clean, suddenly we got an increase in chlorinated solvent, so they thought there may be a source somewhere in the overburden. We did go out with a MIP and just did an overburden investigation where we could push, and we could only get down about 20 feet typically, and you know what? We found the source, and it probably is the source of this dilute plume. It was very isolated, very small. We happened to hit it. I told them, you probably don't want to do it. It's a needle in a haystack. You're probably not going to find it. I don't want you to be disappointed. But we did happen to find it. The passive sampling would probably be a good way to do it. We have a TAGA, toxic air gas unit, with a triple quadrupole mass spec real-time reading instrument that we use for emergency response work to see if, you know, people are in danger, you know, from a fire or train wreck or something like that. And we do a lot of vapor intrusion work with it too. It is so sensitive, it sees parts per trillion. So we can go out and put, soil probes in the ground, and, you know, when you can sniff at that level of detection, down to, you know, parts per billion or parts per trillion, you can find sources that way and then go to whatever other technique you might need to do further investigation. But it helps you zero in on where you might have the problem that you're looking for.
Okay, excellent.
Couple ideas.
We have run about 5 minutes past our scheduled end time. So, Tom, I'm going to close with this one last question before I go through our final reminders today. And many people have been interested in your proposition and have other site-specific or perhaps more technical questions for you. So what would you recommend for an individual who wants to learn more or perhaps is interested in engaging with you with this type of approach on one of their sites? What should they do?
Call me. Phone call or email. I don't necessarily know all the answers, but I can. You can talk to contractors that use these technologies. You can certainly call me, email me, and I'll put you in touch with whoever I think is the best person for your situation. If I can help you, I'd be certainly glad to at least share with you anything I might know to guide you along the way and pass you off to a better qualified expert. Whatever you need. Right now, it's kind of word of mouth, you know, as we get this case study system up and running, you have a lot of contacts. So that's the information we're trying to gather so that you have a lot of people to talk to, and we're working on that over the next 6 to 9 months, and hopefully we'll have that prototype system up and running for everybody. And the IRTC, or ITRC, Advanced Characterization Techniques Committee. You know, look for information to be published from them. That we're getting a lot of industry experts together, you know, many of them, and we're going to start to write guidance on all of these technologies. So that's a group of experts that you can tap into right now. I don't know exactly how to contact them yet. I just joined that team, but there are a lot of experts there. So things will be coming. But you do have my email at the beginning of the presentation. You can always contact me.
All right. Thank you so much, Tom. Lots of thank yous and kudos coming in from the live audience. So I apologize for going a bit over, but it looked like there were just a ton of questions, and you all hung in to the very end. So let me walk through just a few final reminders. As Tom has mentioned, his contact information was available at the start. You'll find it on the seminar homepage as well. Just want to remind everybody that there is copies of the presentation content available to download from that seminar homepage. So if you're looking for the slides or resources, again, follow the link to the seminar homepage and click on the tab for seminar materials. If you joined today, please take a moment and fill out our online feedback form. I will ask each of you to let us know what you thought of today's broadcast, both in the content that we covered and the approach that we used for hosting today's session. Those of you who ask for participation certificates, that's exactly how you'll get one, by filling out that online feedback form. There's a box that you can check at the very bottom of that form. As long as you check that box to certify you were here for the entire session, as soon as you submit your feedback form, you'll immediately we have access to a seminar participation certificate like this that you can either print out or save as a PDF file. You can also have a copy emailed to you. But you have to be sure to do that at the time of filling out the seminar feedback form. If you fill out the feedback form and don't check the box, you won't get one of these forms, or probably one of these certificates, so you can go back to that feedback link and fill it out to generate one of them. If you happen to participate in a group, each one of you can fill out that feedback form on your own and get your own certificate, even if you participated, again, under somebody else's registration. So I included that link in the Q&A window. It's also on the middle right. If you were one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still click the link to the feedback.